From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, and I'm broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Well, friends, last week we witnessed a week of Thanksgiving and a week of tragedy. At home and abroad. We've all seen and heard of the destruction that occurred last week when a group of 10 terrorists attacked sites throughout the city of Mumbai, India, and killed more than 170 people. On today's show, we'll look beyond the pictures that have been plastered across cable news channels to get to some personal perspectives on this tragedy. Coming up later in the show, we'll speak with a member of the Jewish Orthodox movement, Chabad Lubavitch, about the two members of the Chabad tradition, a rabbi and his wife, who perished in those attacks. And I'll share some of my own thoughts about the senseless violence that erupted at a Long Island Walmart, resulting in the death of a store employee. But first, as I learned of the murderous spree that was unfolding on the other side of the world in Mumbai, I wondered immediately how it must feel to see such violence undertaken in the name of your country or your religion. And I then thought of a good friend, a man with whom I've engaged in numerous interfaith dialogues over the years, with whom I've traveled, with whom I have laughed, and with whom I have worked. Dr. Nazir Khaja is an internationally known American Muslim leader and peace activist. He's an advocate. He serves as chairman of the Board of Islamic Information Services in California, and he's been my guest on State of Belief before. Nazir Khaja is also a practicing medical doctor. In fact, he joins me now by phone from his hospital in California. Nazir, thank you for speaking with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you for having me, Walton. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
We've all been disturbed by the horrors of the terrorist attacks in Mumbai that we have watched on television. But I don't want you to take us to the streets of Mumbai. I want you to take us into the heart. You're from Pakistan. You have family in Pakistan. You love the people there. How did you feel when you first heard of the attacks on Mumbai?
As you said, one word that describes the feeling is horror. But as you also know, that these acts of terror that we see daily, and more or less we are getting numbed by the scenes of horror. If not Mumbai, it is it's Iraq. It is not Iraq. It's somewhere else. So I think the one word that describes is horror and a deep sense of grief and loss at this senselessness.
Nazir, did the attacks surprise you, or did you somehow say to yourself, I knew it was only a matter of time?
Well, I think this is certainly not the first attack of terror in India, and it won't be the last either, I dare say, and I'm disappointed to say that. And when I say India, I want you also to know that my family originally came from India, but so I was born in India and then migrated to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of love and affection for people in India also, who are my people. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I look at the whole region in despair and in awe. And there are several reasons that all of this is happening. It is a multi-system failure that you can apply that expression to the entire region, which consists of India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh. In all of these areas, different kinds of struggle are going on, basically due to failed economies, failed policies, and a number of other reasons which only bring out the worst in humankind. And when there is no hope coming from the leadership and from those who people believe or have faith in making their lives better, they gravitate towards the worst aspects of religion.
Nazir, this may be an unfair question, but you know that region well. What do you think is going to happen? I have another friend with close ties to Pakistan who wrote me saying that she had deep fears related to what would transpire in South Asia in the next several months. What do you think is going to happen there?
I think vis-a-vis Pakistan, if the question is in that region, Pakistan has internal problems and external threats. The political system is so fragile. The government is totally incapable of handling a whole host of issues, including economic issues. Given that factor, then there is this external threat, which is heightened by the action of desperate people. So there is both being nuclear powers, India and Pakistan, there is always that imminent danger. But I think with the help now Secretary Rice is there, she's trying to negotiate that, that all of those gestures would be helpful in appeasing the anger and looking at a regional solution in Afghanistan, where war is continuing to have its impact, and we are losing our own soldiers there also. So I think the new administration, hopefully, that is coming in here would be helpful and would see the situation in a different lens than what it has been so far.
Mm-hmm. I want to press you a little bit on that, and I do so with an image in my mind. The image is of you getting in the face of Milosevic and shouting at him, opinions about his behavior. So I know you don't mind speaking truth to power. What would you tell the president-elect if you could talk with him? What would you tell him about how to handle what has happened in Mumbai and the ramifications in the region?
I can tell you, sometime back when President Musharraf took over in 1999, I had an interview with him, and at that time, one of the people who was on the list of the Indian government submitted to Pakistan that they extradite him to India, his name is Maulana Azhar, he's a religious leader. He was in Indian prison, and he was just released at that time, and he had come to Pakistan. And I was sitting, and he, after coming to Pakistan, he declared that every American should be killed. So I was sitting with President Musharraf, and this is in the television interview. I said, "How could you allow this man to be roaming around free at that time, when he's saying all Americans should be killed, and I'm an American?" And I protested. So at that time, President Musharraf had just taken over, and he said, "Well, I don't know enough about it. Maybe he didn't say this, or I'll verify that." And he walked away. I'm recalling this incident only to say that that kind of religion has taken root there. That has to be eliminated, lock, stock, and barrel. There is no room and no purpose in any society for that kind of religion. And I would tell him that.
Dr. Nazir Khaja is an internationally known American Muslim leader, a peace activist, and advocate. He serves as chairman of the Board of Islamic Information Services. He's a good friend. He's also a good medical doctor. Nazir, thank you for talking with us on State of Belief.
Pleasure to be with you, Welton.
I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief. And we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, We'll continue our conversation about the attacks in Mumbai, and I'll be joined by a rabbi from the Chabad Lubavitch movement. He'll tell us about the two members of his faith who were killed during that attack on Chabad House in Mumbai. Please stay tuned. Everybody, I am Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief. Throughout the country this week, Americans mourned the loss of life that occurred in the Indian city of Mumbai, and particular attention has been paid to the six Americans who were killed in the attacks there. Two of the victims were a young American rabbi and his wife, who had moved to Mumbai 5 years before to open up a Jewish center in the Indian city. Rabbi Gabriel Noach Holzberg and his wife Rivka were both members of Chabad Lubavitch, an Orthodox Jewish movement that began in 18th century Russia. Today, the spiritual headquarters of Chabad Lubavitch are located in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York. And I am joined now by a Chabad rabbi, Rabbi Simcha Weinstein of the congregation B'nai Avraham, located in Brooklyn Heights. Now, if you've listened to State of Belief across the years, you've heard Rabbi Simcha before. He's been a guest on our program. He's usually on to talk about his books on Judaism and pop culture, and you probably would remember that he and I have laughed a lot together. But today he joins us under very different circumstances. Rabbi Simcha, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you very much, Welton. It's a pleasure, as always, to be on the show.
And you have my condolences as well as continued prayers for the situation that has occurred and that we're going to talk about now.
I appreciate everything.
Thank I know you. It's been a difficult time for the Chabad community, but I think it might be good for you to tell our listeners first a little bit about this tradition and what took Rabbi Holzberg and his wife from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, to Mumbai, India.
Sure. I mean, I belong to the Chabad Lubavitch Network. We have 7,000 outreach rabbis and rebbetzins spread out in 73 countries, and it is our purpose and our belief and our mission to go to areas where Judaism is not readily available and to open synagogues and day schools and preschools and make kosher food and services and Torah learning available for those who would ordinarily not have the resources to do so.
It's safe to say these were two people who were truly living their faith by going to Mumbai.
Very, very special people, which is what's making this such a painful time. This was a couple, the Holzbergs, who went to a place where there was nothing. I mean, if you're going to be strict in your observance of kosher, there is nothing in Mumbai, India. Rivka Holzberg is a woman who baked every single cookie, every single bread. Any chickens they ate on the Sabbath were shechted by Rabbi Gabriel Holzberg himself. He was also the mohel. He would perform circumcisions. His wife would be in charge of the mikveh, the ritual immersion pool. They left the creature comforts of New York City to go to a place of real poverty and bring so much love and warmth to a community.
The Chabad Lubavitch have centers around the world, as you indicated, and yet, as I understand it, it remains a very tight-knit community. Tell us a little bit about the impact of this tradition on the larger community and on Judaism.
I mean, we really feel like one big family. And I can tell you some of the internal emails that have been going on over the last week. It really goes from two extremes. One is shock, sadness, and sorrow. We feel like we've lost a member of our family, every one of us. And the other extreme is that of the need to do more, the need to spread light. The Holzberg's murder was terribly, it was a terrible act of evil. The world is a darker place, and we have resolved ourselves to respond by making the world a brighter place. We're going to open our doors wider. We're going to take the doors off the hinges. We're going to spread more love. We're going to open more institutions for Jews that don't have a place to go, where it's not readily available. And that's really our purpose. It's our mission. It's our pleasure.
What did you say to your people?
The first thing I told my community is that it's difficult to even comprehend what's happened. And sometimes it's futile to even do so. Such an act of atrocity, of murder, of mutilation, it's the real primal evil. You know, I tell my community, don't think about why these things happen, but we have to mourn, and at the same time, we have to act. And I'm encouraging my community to take part, to give extra charity, to light the Sabbath candles, to attend Torah classes. And I'm also speaking about the heroism of this incredible Indian nanny, Sandra Samuel. It's an incredible story. This was a lady, a non-Jewish lady, who was hiding in the closet, and she heard the cry of the Holzberg's child, baby Moshe, and she had everything to lose from leaving that closet, but she chose to be brave, just like the Talmud says, if you save a life, you save the world entire. She was able to save baby Moshe, and it also reminds me perhaps of the story of Moses in the Bible, who was saved by the daughter of Pharaoh, Bathsheba, from the bulrushes, and she was able to save this child and perhaps have a small miracle in all this terrible turmoil.
Simcha Weinstein, you're quite a rabbi.
Thank you.
I admire the work that you do at the Congregation B'nai Avraham Chabad Lubavitch Congregation, located in Brooklyn Heights. Not only am I grateful for you talking with me today, but we will laugh again soon.
I think we will. And for always for Jews, laughter has been a coping mechanism. Saul Bellow once noted, depressed people tend to be witty. I think it's because Jews have unfortunately suffered so much throughout the ages that we've been able to overcome this sadness through joy and through laughter. Now is a time to mourn, but soon will be a time again to laugh.
Consider yourself a primal facilitator of laughter.
You know, my name is Simcha, which is the Hebrew word for joy. So I don't have a choice in the matter. It's in my DNA.
Take care of yourself, and I look forward to being in touch soon.
God bless.
Coming up on State of Belief, I have my own reflections on another tragedy that occurred this past week at a Walmart in Long Island, New York, when crowds that couldn't wait long enough to enter the store trampled a store employee to death. My thoughts on that when we come back. I hope you'll be here with us. See you in a moment. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Your head may still be spinning from the events of last week, as is mine, but I still want to share some thoughts with you in a segment that we like to call Amen. Preaching to the Choir.
Amen. 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 With the horns now.
First of all, I hope your Thanksgiving Day was a good one, and that you're not still suffering the consequences of eating too much turkey and dressing or consuming an outrageous quantity of potatoes. But overconsumption seems to be the theme of the season into which Thanksgiving Day ushers our nation. Now, believe me, I'm not equating eating too much on Thanksgiving Day with the orgy of greed that pervades our society during the all-out sprint toward December 25th, into which we launch ourselves from the starting blocks of the day after Thanksgiving called Black Friday. The concern of which I'm speaking is of a level of severity that threatens the very society of which it's a part. By now, I guess everyone knows the tragic story. A 34-year-old Walmart employee on Long Island was trampled to death under the rush of shoppers that moved like a stampeded herd of mad cattle trying to get a bargain buy before all the bargains were gone. When the shoppers were asked to exit the store because of the death of the man they trampled, shoppers protested because they had lined up early to shop and they weren't about to allow a tragedy to halt their crazed spending. Now keep in mind that supposedly the reason for this irrational behavior was keeping the spirit of the Christmas season by purchasing gifts for loved ones. Well, pardon my cynicism, bordering on outright negativism, but I think the tragedy played out on the floor of a Walmart store on Long Island is a symptom of an out-of-control consumerism that reflects a selfishness and greed that are in large part contributors to the economic crisis in our nation. Over the past several weeks, we have gained important insights into the priorities of the nation in which we live. For example, we now know that though our government has repeatedly told us there is no money available for giving more help to poor people, failing educational institutions, and people without health care or health insurance, but there is money available if major financial institutions get sick as a consequence of a bad case of greed. We know that accountability for the government money is not required at upper levels of income, only for those who are trying to help someone but encountering reams of red tape. You know, we now know some stuff that before we only expected. People be damned who get in the way of our pursuit of a Merry Christmas, or of our attempted recovery of an economy better suited for investment bankers, Wall Street brokers, and people worried because they've lost millions of dollars in the economic downturn. A few weeks ago on State of Belief, some of you will remember, we had Susan Brooks Thistlewaite, a theologian, with us, and she and I discussed a moral economy. Susan made the astute observation that greed does not work as a guiding economic principle. Correct. If anyone questions that declaration of absolutism, look at the pictures of Walmart shoppers tearing down the doors on Black Friday and before they had spent all their money, leaving a man on the floor dead from having been knocked down and stepped on as a result of shoppers more interested in securing bargains than protecting life. Or look at the daily fluctuations in efforts to stabilize our economy. There's a better way to do Christmas. There's a better way to nurse the economy. And there is a better way to do community. Let's hope that Americans from Washington to Wall Street to Walmart will realize that. Well, friends, there's still more to come here on State of Belief. We've got to take a quick break again, but first, I've got a riddle of sorts for you. Now, listen carefully. What do ice cream, coffee, the Alamo, and the work of the poet Rumi all have in common? And what do they possibly have to do with religion? I've got the answer. And I'll tell you if you're here when I come back. So don't go anywhere. You'll be fascinated with the answer. Welcome back, friends. I'm Welton Gaddy. Any time extremists engage in violence, as happened this past week in India, many begin to think the sick and deplorable actions of a very few people characterize a whole religion or an entire culture. Here in America, in the weeks and months after September 11th, Muslim citizens who had absolutely no connection to Al-Qaeda found themselves the victims of backlash simply because of their faith, a faith which is often seen as foreign and guilty by association and fundamentally un-American. Well, a new book, a very fine new book, hopes to counter some of the fears of Islam or of Arabs by examining the many ways Arab influences have actually shaped American culture, from food to literature to words like algebra or orange. These stories and more fascinating anecdotes than you can imagine are gathered in a new book called Al America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. The author is Jonathan Curiel, a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jonathan now joins me by phone. Jonathan, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, it's really something. It runs the gamut from Arab influences on American architecture to the English language to music. So I'm wondering, once you got started on this, did you see influences that you didn't anticipate, or did you start out knowing that you were going to find that much information?
No, I started out knowing a little bit of this information because I had written about it before for the San Francisco Chronicle, but I didn't know, as one particular example, I didn't know about the Alamo in San Antonio being influenced by Islamic architecture. I didn't know about New Orleans being influenced by Islamic design patterns, and it was only when I went to these cities that it occurred to me that there was probably a reference here, and that was because of the Spanish culture, the Spanish influence. And having done research at Oxford University, I knew perfectly well that when you think of Spanish influence, you often think of it's actually Islamic influence or a combination thereof. Mm-hmm. And so these two examples, New Orleans and San Antonio, were good examples of what I found along the way.
How difficult was it to get information like you found? I mean, it is indeed pretty much an untold history, as you've illustrated, and most of it was relegated to, I think these are your words also, obscure academic tomes and dusty library books. So you had your work cut out for you. How did you even know where to look?
Yeah, I did have my work cut out for me. A lot of the book is based on hunches. Huh. And again, I had done research in England. I had a feeling, a fairly good feeling, that there were these influences. But again, going to these places made me realize, yeah, I think there is an influence here. But it was only when I went to these, dusty history books that I realized, wait a minute, here is a specific reference to Arabic, the Arabic language. Here's a specific reference to Islamic architecture. I put two and two together, as it were. And then I create a bigger picture. I created a bigger picture. And these weren't isolated cases, by the way, either. And this is one of the astounding things of my book, I think. You have the Alamo in San Antonio. You have New Orleans, the so-called French Quarter, which is really should be thought of as the Spanish Quarter. And beyond that, a kind of Spanish, French, Muslim, Cajun Quarter, really. Mm-hmm. But you have all these other examples. And perhaps the most surprising, or maybe one of the most surprising, was going to Christopher Columbus himself. And I wanted to start at the start of this country's founding with Christopher Columbus. I had a feeling there were influences there because of his time in Spain. Mm-hmm. And there were influences there, and I was surprised at how deep they were. For example, with Christopher Columbus, it's not only language. And with Columbus, it's with the title, his very coveted title he had. That title is Almirante del Mar Oceano, which means Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Now, Almirante is from an Arabic word, Al-Amir, which means the commander. And this title was given to Columbus by Queen Isabella herself. So here was an example of how, despite the Reconquista, despite the fact that Spain purged Muslims from Spain, They actually embraced Arab and Muslim culture, and this is one of the contradictions that I wanted to write about in my book. And it wasn't just language with Christopher Columbus. It was navigational techniques that were perfected by Arabs and Muslims. And he specifically cites Muslims in his journals, credits them for aiding him on his journeys to the New World. This is something I had never, ever found in any history book. I found a particular quote in an English translation of a Spanish book. And as far as I know, a lot of the information in Al-America, in my book, has not really been known, is not known to the general public.
Jonathan, how in the world did you find out that an ice cream cone was actually invented by Syrian immigrants?
Well, this is actually something that had been written about before I researched my book. Several outlets had reported the ice cream cone as being connected to several Syrians, one of whom, Abe Dumar, came to this country before the 1904 World's Fair. Now, I interviewed Abe Dumar's descendants, and they told me a rather fantastical tale that hasn't been told before, and that is that the Dumar family came to this country before 1904, before the World's Fair in St. Louis. Abe Dumar was one of the people who were trying to sell goods there, and Abe Dumar was actually not selling ice cream cones. He was selling holy water from Jerusalem, from Israel and Palestine. Now, Abe Dumar also was familiar with the zalabiya, this kind of waffle-like pastry that was also sold at the World's Fair. Now, next to Abe Dumar's concession was this ice cream stand. And in 1904 in America, ice cream was sold in cups and saucers. Now, that made for problems because if people walked away with those cups and saucers, there went a lot of the profit. Now, Abe Dumar recognized that wait a minute, what would happen if we rolled up this zalabiya, these waffle-like pastries, into a conical shape, which is what they do in the Middle East. He was very familiar with this idea. He rolled up such a pastry into a conical shape after this ice cream stand next to him ran out of plates and saucers, and thus was born the ice cream cone. Now, Abe Dumar and, to some extent, Ernest Hamwi, another Syrian man who accompanied Abe Dumar to St. Louis, they are generally credited with inventing the ice cream cone and popularizing it in this country. Abe Dumar specifically, and I interviewed his descendants, and they told me one reason they came to this country in the late 1800s and early 1900s is because, you know, he was accused of a crime in Syria. Now, Abe Dumar is a Christian Arab man, and he was accused by another man in Syria of a crime. And if it wasn't for that accusation, the ice cream cone might not have been born as it was at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904.
I mean, you must be really good at dinner parties.
That's good. Well, you know what? I think I've turned into a pretty good dinner guest. I'm taking invitations even as we speak. And a lot of this information does lend itself to these anecdotes, but I think they add up, and I say this in the book, I think they add up to a bigger picture of give and take between the America and the Arab and Muslim world, mm-hmm, in ways that a lot of us, including me before I wrote the book, don't know about.
Yeah. Jonathan, you talk about the fact that Islam and Sufi poetry in particular influenced a lot of early American writers, even writers like Emerson and Thoreau. But also that in that environment, Americans were standoffish about Muslims because most of what they knew about Islam was filtered through the lens of war. And reading that, I couldn't help but think about the perceptions of Islam today, which are disturbing, to say the least. What would you say to the American people based on what you learned then about perceptions of Islam now?
Yeah, this is a good question because this is an example of history repeating itself. In the 1800s, in the mid-1800s, as Ralph Waldo Emerson was studying Islam, studying Sufi poetry from Persia, America was having an antagonistic relationship toward the Muslim world, and that was mainly because of the Ottoman world, because of Ottoman Turkey. At that point, they had nominal control over the Holy Land, over Jerusalem. There was, of course, the spread of Islam through Europe, and so there was this idea of a clash of religions, of a clash of civilizations, as it were. But Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, studied Islam, studied it through this book called The Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People. This came out in the year 1839, and as I point out in my book, this was a book that tried to look at the Muslim world through a lens other than violence. And there were reviews at the time, not only in the United States but in Europe, that said if we knew more about the Muslim world through books like this, through The Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People, there would be less a call for war with Ottoman, with the Ottoman Muslim world. And at one point, a reviewer said, and in fact, we went to war on phony precepts, essentially, on the precept that Muslims were just totally violent and nothing else. Now, I think there is parallel to the present day. I think if more people, especially President Bush, had known more, knew more about the Muslim world, knew about it through other than violence, through other than the fundamentalism that exists there, and I think we're all against that fundamentalism. But I think if people knew more about that world, there would be more of an understanding of that world and dare I say, more empathy for that world. I've lived in Pakistan. I've traveled a lot in the Arab and Muslim world. I've done stories on terrorism. I know that these stories are legitimate, but it doesn't mean that we can't have stories that talk about the other side of the Arab and Muslim world. This book is all about the other side. It's about Islamic architecture. It's about food and language and literature. And I really, really hope that if people read the book, they'll also be better educated and see the Arab and Muslim world for more than just religion, more than just violence, more than just fundamentalism, and more than just the headlines that we get every 5 minutes.
Jonathan Curiel is a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. His new book is called Al America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. Jonathan, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this week. Don't forget, you are as much a part of this show as Julie, our producer, or me, the host. We want to hear your thoughts about what's been discussed on the show or anything else that's on your mind. Go to stateofbelief.com, click on the Contact Us page where you can send us an email. Get involved in a conversation with us. We can learn from you, I'm sure. And while you're visiting stateofbelief.com, I hope you'll consider making a financial contribution to the show. Yes, it's tough times for everyone, I know that. But your support will help keep State of Belief on the air and going strong. So please consider becoming a donor to the program. We promise to put your donations to good use. And as always, I must remind you that State of Belief is produced by Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. You want to get involved in protecting religious liberty in America? Then become a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week, we'll be right back here with more conversations about religion, politics, culture, and a whole lot of other stuff. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.